So hi guys, my name is Leon. I'm on the grad here, and today I'm going to be giving a talk over this thing I studied for the last year on my own. It's algebra geometry. And I personally, I learned this basically from Robert Vakil. He wrote a series of lecture notes. Algebra geometry is called the foundation of algebra geometry. So if you want to ask me any question, I probably would base it off this book. So let's get into it. So what is algebra geometry? So algebra geometry is a subject, a mathematical subject that was there a long time ago. Greek learned something about it. If you're looking at solving like quadratic or degree three polynomials, that can be considered a branch of algebra geometry. But in its essence, algebra geometry is a study of zeros of polynomials. So for example, if you have the real plane in R2, right, and you're asking what's a circle, you can describe circle as the locus of this set, or you can put this right. Right, the locus is when a polynomial is equal to zero. And so we ask what the locus is, and it looks like this. Wow, it's like that guy. I can't just say that. And so that's really what it is. And obviously, we can make it a higher dimensional. We can go to Rn for any n we want, right? We can extend this into a hypersphere. Yeah, hypersphere, I think. Right, and we can ask questions like, what is it, like geometrically intuitive questions. So over the course of history, algebra geometry became really algebra, which I was adding in the beginning, but in its essence, it is still a geometric thing. So for the first half of the lecture, I'm going to talk about classical algebra geometry. So what classical means is, at least in my mind, is anything before a mathematician named Alexander Grothendieck came along and just basically destroyed everything we ever know. But before that, algebra geometry was a study of something called varieties. So the first question is, what is a variety? And the best way to explain it is that if you come, we're gonna do it over C. I know R is probably more intuitive, most people the real numbers, but we're going to do it over C because C has the nice property of being algebraically closed. Yeah? So imagine you have the vector space Cn. Okay? And in it, you can just imagine each point in the vector space is like a point in an n-dimensional thing, right? So it has n coordinates, right? So you have C1. Cn, right? So you have this vector space. If I have a function on the vector space, say f, we can ask what is the locus that f of what is the set of points? We're going to call this variety b equal to the set of points c1 to cn such that f of c1 to Cn equal to 0, right? So we imagine this as we have a function and it cuts out something in our empty space, which in this case is Cn. Is that making sense to you all? Yeah? Okay. Now, obviously, we can have more than one function on this. So we can have, a list of functions. And we ask, what are the points that they are all equal to zero? So for example, I can have, so again, going back to R2, you have a circle. Then you can ask, what's in the section? So I want this I want it to be on the circle, also on this line, x equal to y, right? So now the only points on R2 that satisfy that is these two points, right? Now, these two points are the variety, in this case, of a, you know, equation for the circle and the line. And we consider them kind of like intersection of polynomials. So that's what variety is. It's the points in Cn cut out by a bunch of polynomials in n variables, right? So we're looking at the locus of these points. Now, why is this interesting? So I'm going to introduce a couple of fundamental concepts that is like it's easier to explain in variety instead of in scheme theoretic theory, which is going to be the second half of this lecture. So the first thing we're going to look at is smoothness. So what smoothness is actually a concept we steal from differential geometry, which is kind of like the opposite of algebraic geometry in that you use analytic methods to analyze geometric objects. So in differential geometry, the mean focus is manifolds. In algebraic geometry, we have this notion of varieties. But smoothness is something we actually steal from differential geometry. The idea is that if you have a curve, if you have a curve that's nice enough in R2, then at each point, calculus tell you that you can have a tangent line to the curve, right? So we can think of that as a one-dimensional. We associate a one-dimensional vector space, right? So this line is one-dimensional, right? And how do we extend this notion? Because there's some other curve out there, and I'm going to draw one right now. Let's see. XY equal to x6 plus y6. And if you put in Wolfram alpha, like I did, this is what you get. Okay, so that's the curve cuts out in R2. Now, if you look at each point, so if you pick a point here, you can see like kind of where you can go is only one-dimensional, right? So you can only go in this direction. It's a one-dimensional vector space. But if you look at the origin, you really have two dimensions, right? If you extend it up, you have it's really a two-dimensional thing, right? And this is bad because, again, so if you're going back to differential manifold, what that means is that if you zoom in enough at this point, you kind of have a higher dimensional object. And in manifolds, as we all know, you know, it's something that locally looks like Rn. And n is a constant. It has to stay the constant. So for another example, maybe this one is even better. If you have a cone, the reason a cone is not a manifold is because at this point, it doesn't look like everywhere else. Everywhere else, if you zoom in enough, you will see R2. But at this point, it's not. And the smoothness is the idea that at every single point, it's kind of smooth. It doesn't have anything sticking out. And by sticking out, it means that, well, the tangent space has a higher dimension. So how does this notion go into, because this notion itself is inherently analytic. So our first question is that, how are we going to define smoothness, and why is it nice? And it turns out, the way you calculate smoothness, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you just, actually, I don't know how you do it in different geometry. Never mind, I'm just going to talk about how we're doing algebraic geometry. So so I'm just going to do it in one dimension. So for example, the circle, x squared plus y squared is 1. And the circle, right? It's pretty nice, right? Every single point is the tangent space is one-dimensional, right? So how we actually do it is that we are looking at the gradient. Do anybody know what the gradient is of the polynomial? So the gradient for in this case is the partial derivative of f. It's the partial derivative against x times the x vector plus the partial derivative of y times assign a little vector to it, right? So this is a gradient, and what we're saying is that if a curve has a gradient, that means you want to go somewhere. Then Does that make any sense? And in this case, that coincides with the notion that it's one-dimensional, that it has a tangent. So if you're doing this case, the gradient against x is 2x, and the gradient against y is 2y. And if you ask if both of these vanishes, then obviously x and y has to be 0, right? Which is not going to occur. Right, so we really, so what we look for is we look at f equals to the different, the you know, the partial derivative with, again, with respect to x, and the partial derivative with respect to y, it all vanishes at a point. And if that happens, then that point is not smooth. So if we bring back this example, if we take another look at this, which is xy minus x plus 6 minus y plus 6 equals 0. And if you're partial, if you're looking at this, and if you look at the origin, then the partial derivative against x is x minus 6 x to the 5th, and against y is x minus 6y to the 5th. And if you plug 0 into both of them, you get 0. So the gradient vanishes, and the point is actually in the polynomial. Therefore, it is not smooth. Right? Does that make any sense? And so now, first question, I just want to get this over with. How do you actually define differentiation in algebraic geometry? It's actually really easy. You actually just say that the differential of this. You just say that x to the n differential against x is n x to the n minus 1. And because, you know, we don't deal with continuity, so we don't actually have to worry about like proving this. We just actually define it this way. And it actually works out. And this is good because in algebraic geometry, and if you study algebraic number theory, you're not going to be working over fields such as C and R. You know, it's going to be Q. And in extreme cases, F2. But I want to know why you would do that. So more generally, if you have a variety that's cut out by a bunch of polynomials, so CV is being cut out by F1 to Fn, then V is and V has dimension. Let's say B. Now, how do you actually count the dimension of a variety? Now, again, in manifolds it's easy because in manifold we assume it's smooth. So actually just zoom in and say the dimension of the tangent space is the dimension of the manifold. But in this case, it's a little bit tougher than that. It has to deal with, essentially have to deal with the crude dimension of a ring, but we're not going to get into that. We're going to get into that in the second section. So see, if you have dimension D, then if we look at the generalization of that, which is going to be what we call the Jacobian matrix. Right, so in, let's say, C to the M, so we have variable x1 to xn. If you look at a Jacobian, and it turns out the co-rank, so which is going to be m minus the rank of the Jacobian is equal to d at every single point, then it is smooth. That's how we define it. And it's not really intuitive, but you actually do the same, again, you do the same thing in differential manifold, because you are really thinking about partial derivative are kind of like linear direction, right, so tangent, right, so you talk about linear direction against all aspects, and you kind of see how this, the dimension of this holds, and it cuts all these functions right here, they cut up linear equation at every single point, and the more they cut out, the less dimension it has, and the thing we're worried is that at, you know, degenerate situations, it doesn't cut up enough dimension, like in this case, in the origin. And in every single other place, you know, it cut enough dimension, therefore it is smooth. Okay? So that's the idea of smoothness.
And one, actually, so in algebra geometry, one dominating motivation in studying algebra geometry was, if you have a non-smooth thingy, how can you like make it better? Because we like it smooth. Because, yeah, we just do it. So for example, if you have this thing, we call it a cusp. So what it is the equation x squared equal to y to the cube, right? And this point is, it is not smooth. And if you do, again, if you do the partial derivative, you will get zero on both sides. You put it using the c. And the reason that it's not smooth is obviously at this point. It forms a cup, kind of like the cone situation we had. And one of the questions we had is, maybe we can have something that parameterizes this. So maybe we can have something that have a map. So what we're looking at, looking at a map from another variety into this, such that this map is nice. So for example, you want to be subjective, right? You don't want me just missing out this point because I can just take this point off, right? But that doesn't make any sense, right? So you want to be subjective and you want this to be smooth. And I mean, if you look at this, you can just say, why can't I just take a line and just kind of put it here and like create a cusp here, right? And in fact, we actually can do that. So what we do is we actually introduce, so say, for example, if we have a line here, right? So if you have a line T, and we actually can map this to that by map T to T squared and T cubed. And you will get what you want. T cubed, T squared. Yeah. This is X, and this is Y. Notice how T cubed to the square is equal to T squared cubed. Right, yeah, it turns out this map is a really nice map. So we call this resolution of singularities, right? So points, the bad points are singularities. And we actually resolved it by parameterizing it with another line. And more formally, and this is really cool, people prove that you can actually basically resolute almost all singularities, especially in Q or in C. I don't know about finite characteristics. But the way that people can do this generally with really, really bad curves, such as this one. This is called a tag node. It's x squared equal to x4 plus y4. And it's pretty bad. The way they do it is that you actually consider the ambient space. So, for example, this time we're going to take a, so this is R2, right? So you take R2. Actually, we're gonna discuss this after the next topic because I actually have to introduce something. Sorry about that. So our question is, if you have a curve or something in a variety and it's not smooth, how can we like find something that map to it that's nice enough, but that thing itself is smooth? And the way we do it is we have to introduce a new concept into algebra geometry. And again, this is known a long time ago, probably, I know it's before 12th century, and it's called projective geometry. That's our solution. So, projective geometry, and what projective geometry is what we said is that if we look at R2, we say that R2 itself is not nice enough, and it's lacking something. So what I mean is that, so if you think of R2, which is, you know, the plane, right? And if you have two points, what you get a line, right? And two points uniquely identify a line, right? So if you give me any two distinct points, I give you a line. But what happens if I give you two lines? What happens? You get a point. But do you always get a point? No, right? Because sometimes lines go parallel to each other. Right, so if I'm a mathematician, I'm looking at this. Now I want to say, okay, so 2 points makes a line, right? But two lines does not make a point, right? Which is really sad because we really want two lines to make a point. So what people start doing is that they will say, if two lines doesn't make a point, we kind of add a point in infinity. And we say it meets at that point, and deal with that. So now, if you do that, then you get two lines. Miss a point. Okay? And now, how do we do that? And I'm going to actually show you three construction of the projective space, right? So we're going to call this Pn. You can do it, so, well, actually, if you do it over real numbers, you get Prn. If you do it over complex numbers, you get Pcn. So what you do is that, so basically the idea is that if I have, so imagine 3D. So imagine another example being 3D. If I have a plane, right, and I have a line, right? Now, if you look at dimension, the dimension of the plane is 2. Dimension of the line is 1. They add up to 3, right? And the idea is that we want them to intersect. If the sums of the dimension, so if the two objects have dimension that's big enough, so in the example, in dimension 2, so in R square, if we have two lines, then they should intersect because the dimension is big enough. But that's clearly not the case, right? So the idea is that we want things that has big enough dimension to intersect. And the way we do that is construct this magical thing. It's called a projective space. And this three construction to it, three construction. And this is probably the easiest one to understand. So you consider in Rn plus 1, right? So Rn plus 1, it has n plus 1 dimensions. Again, you can do this over C too, and you can do this with any field, and it's even better if you do it with the Hamiltonians because they're not in a field. But anyway, so if you have R n plus 1, you have the circle, right? We go back to the circle, while the hypersphere in R n plus 1. So how do we construct PRn? What you do is that you actually take the antipodal points, so the points that are opposite of each other across the origin, and we identify them together. So what you do is, quotient is our big thing in mathematics. So what you do is kind of glue them together, and we call that PRN. Okay, and that sounds really bad right now, but I'm going to give you an example. So in two dimension, if you think about it, in two dimension, so if you glue every point to a point opposite to it, you kind of flip it over, and what you really only have left are these two points, which you glue together. So in effect, what you get is a circle. Does that make any sense? No, it's not too long. Okay, so if you think about it, so if we're going to glue every single point with something below it, right, so it's antipodal points, so you won't have to concern about anything that's below here, right? Because it's up here too, right? Now, but these two points across are antipodal to each other. So we glue these two together, and then you uniquely represent the quotient. So what you get is you basically take these two and glue together, and what you get here is a circle. And the way we interpret that is you have your original, this is actually your R. This is your R1 right here. And these two points are the point of infinity. And that's when we can do it. So what you actually suggest is that you have an R1 here, and you have the two point of infinity, this infinity and minus infinity, and we glue this together into a circle. So if you travel far enough, point zero, you will get back to zero if you can go across infinity. And that's how we actually glue this thing together. And why is it useful? So because you look pretty weird right now, and so the reason it's useful because again things doesn't intersect well, right? But if you look at the cube, so if you have the sphere, right? So the three dimensional sphere. So you're being R3. If you look at a sphere, now line. Remember how people tell you lines of the spheres are grid circles, right? So grid circles are the lines, right? So if you think of if you have two grid circles, they always intersect, right? You can just really easily see. Now, the thing is, they intersect at two points, so that's not number one. But notice, if you look at the two points, they are antipodal of each other. So now, if we claim that this point and this point are the same thing, then every single line on this circle intersect at one point, right? And we got our duality, right? And, well, that's basically how it works. So that's how you do it. And a better way to do this, and maybe more, a better way to do this. So this is the first construction. The second one, again, if you have, let's take C this time. If you have the vector space, Cm plus 1, right? And if you give me a vector in a vector space, so if you give me a vector V, I can have the one-dimensional space spanned by V, right? So, you know, if you give me this point, the vector space is this line right here, right? So every single point in this line is being spanned by V, right? So this is V. Now, so consider all the set of all one-dimensional subspace, and we define that as PCN. So PCN is the set of all one-dimensional subspace. And if you look at this definition, it's really clear to you that if you have a vector V, and if you have another vector, KV, so K is a constant, right? So if you have another vector KV, so you will kind of extend up here, right? Then they span the same subspace, right? So multiplication, simple multiplication by coefficients of the field does not affect it, and that's kind of what we want, in a sense. And again, how is this two, well, if you have these two definitions, why are they the same? It's because if you look at a sphere, and if you're looking at a line through the origin, what you get in the intersection is the two equipotential points, which we identify together, right? So in this case, you can kind of see how these two constructions are the same, and which is why people use the first one, because it's more intuitive. Now, the third construction I'm going to give is, this one is probably the least common you're going to see in algebraic geometry, because you can actually do that in algebraic geometry. It's from the, for anyone who studies algebraic topology and CW in composition. This is how you do it. So assume that you have a PCN, and if you have CN already, what you do is that you kind of curve the CN to the top, and you kind of glue PCN around its boundary, and you get your PCN plus 1. I'm sorry, this is PCN minus 1, and you get your PCN. And the way it connects back to those two is if you have a sphere, right? And if you have a point, never mind actually, this is a little bit too out of the way. I'm sorry guys, we're not going to talk about the CW decompositions. Okay, now, so let's go back to blow-ups. So you have a non-smooth curve in this case. Now, how are you going to reduce the singularity? And the thing is, the singularity is only bad at this point, right? Everywhere else is fine. When we solve our last singularity, again, we're only bad at one point. So when we map the line onto here, the only thing that changes here, everything else was the same. So the same idea applies here. So what you do is you go to this point and you see I'm going to look at all the slope of the line at this point. And in this case, the slopes are different, right? So you have this slope, which is x equal to y, and this one is x plus s equal to minus y, right? The slopes are different. So if we say we can actually differentiate the slopes between them, then we resolve our singularity, and we can actually do that. So what you do is that, if you have a singularity point, which we're gonna put at origin, so we consider this space. So you have an, okay, never mind, not an. You have Cn, right? And you have the origin, O, right? Right, what you do is you construct this thing we're going to call, it's another variety, V, with this map, such that, this, how do you imagine this map? Is that away from the origin, so if you have the plane, right, so you have here, away from the origin, if you take this, the origin out, the V, and the plane minus origin, they're the same thing, right? But at the origin, you have P to the you have PCN onto the origin. If you look at the pre-image of set, assets, that's what you get. So basically what it does is that it says that every single point away from origin, I'm going to leave it the same. And at the origin, what I'm going to do is I'm literally going to stuck all the lines that pass through the origin in there. And the actual construction, I'm going to, if you want, I can talk about the actual construction in the second half, because you know I'm actually going to start writing the equations second half. And it turns out, if you do it this way, and if you look at this here, because the slope of the two different kind of tangents that come to this place are different, so it turns out if you do that, you can actually resolve it up here on this one. So we'll call this the blow up. Because it's called blow up because we take a point out and we put PCN in there, which is, you know, humongous. It's not a single point, it's like uncountable, which is a lot. You know? So let's see. Okay, so now we can go to the well, we're really gonna talk about this on this talk, which is the Bezout theorem. This theorem was proved before Internet came along with all this machinery, but it's easier with scheme theoretic things. Basically what it says is that if you think about the plane, so again when you argue, right? If you have a circle which has degree 2, right? So because you have the degree of the polynomial is 2, right? And if you have a line, how many points should they intersect each other at? 2 points, right? And more generally, if you have, let's say, f, and the degree of f is m, and the degree of polynomial g is n, then the intersection, if you can define that, of f and g as curves, should be m plus n points, right? That would make a lot of sense. So for example, even in one dimension, what I'm saying, if you just take the line, let's say y equal to 0, right? So that has degree 1, right? Actually, that's degree 0. No, it has degree 1. Yeah, you take y equal to 0, you kind of project this curve, you're looking at this curve, for example, this curve, and the intersection with the x-axis. So what you get, you're really getting the root of the polynomial. And there should be 3 root, right? Assuming y is equal to 0. So we really want this notion. But the unfortunate thing is, it's clearly not true, because if you have a circle right here, and if you have the tangent line, they really intersect in one place, right? There's really nothing you can do about it. But the trick is that we can actually count things. We can count multiplicities of intersection. So we can say this intersection intersects at one point, but it intersects in such a weird way that we're going to count the S2. Right? So for example, another example would be a elliptical curve. So if you have an elliptical curve, yeah, it goes to 0. So like this, right here. So you know, if you have an elliptical curve, then this intersection, it has multiplicity 2. It has degree 3, it has multiplicity 2, because you actually intersect it on infinity up above. And on this one, this intersects 3 points, and each point has an intersection of multiplicity 1. So we want to make sense of what does that even mean? What do you mean when you say a line is a tangent curve? And how do we prove that if you count everything correctly, then the intersection of a degree m and a degree n curve will have m endpoints. And Bezout theorem, well, says you will have n endpoints. And we're going to talk about how, you know, people get to prove Bezout theorem in the second half of this lecture. So, we're going to take a break now. And the second half is going to be scheme theoretic, and it's going to be a little bit tougher than this. Yeah. Okay. So that's actual geometry. And fun fact, in 16-something, this guy called the Cartesian. Yeah, who's that guy who did the Cartesian coordinates?
Descartes.
Descartes had a quote. He says, there's almost nothing more to study in algebraic geometry. And he was right. Yeah, so came around the 1900s, okay, and we really had this massive improvement in math. It's absolutely insane. So for my talk, the thing we're going to start with is the guy called Lorrain. So this guy actually fought in World War II, and while he was in the prisoner camp, he discovered two things. One is called sheep, and the other one is called spectral sequence. Now, our talk is going to be over sheeps, but spectral sequence. Everyone can learn it. So, sheeps. And so, what is a sheep? A sheep is the idea that if you have a. So, we have this idea of a topological space. Does everybody know what a topological space is? Everyone. Good. So, if you have a topological space, so basically, you're giving some geometric structure to a space. Right, but it doesn't make any sense. And in the 1900s, really came arrived when Grothendieck came around, was this idea that you can study an object by looking at morphisms, in it and from it. And this obviously gives rise to category theory, which is going to be, it's actually revolutionary category theory. But this idea also applied to topology in a different way than people expected. So this is what I mean. If you have, let's say, the torus, right? So you have a torus, which is a donut, we'll call it torus. If you have a torus, then you look at all the maps from the torus to, let's say, R. Okay, so we have a real value torus. We look at all the continuous map from torus to the R. You said, okay, that's cool. But now, what happens is people start realizing this is something called a local global dilemma or something like that, which, you know, it's almost like a struggle. So the idea of a sheep is that I have local informations, and these information are nice enough that they can kind of cooperate with each other. So here's what I mean. So if I have a function from a torus, actually torus is a bad example, a square. If I have a function from the square to the real number line, the square, you know, is 1 and 0, 1. Right? So if I take an open set of the square, say this half, so if I take this half of the square, doesn't that give me a function from this half to the number line? Right? By restriction. Right? Or by composition. And also, doesn't that give me a function from this half? So if I take another open set, this half to the real number line. Right? Again, by restriction. Now, we call this. So the idea is that if you have something that's global, and if you have an open subset in this, I can restrict it down here. Right? So consider on each open subset of the square. So we have a topology on the square, right? So the Euclidean topology. And for every open we're going to define something we're going to call the sheaf. So we're going to write about F. And for every single open subset of the square, what I'm going to have is all the function from the open subset to R. So for example, the whole square itself is an open subset of, you know, trivially. And so the global section of the global, the sheaf associated with the global thing, which is going to be the square map to R. Right. Now notice, if I want to have an open subset, so if I have V in U, then if I have a function from U to R, that's also a function from V to R. Or in categorical terms, we have a map from F of U to F of V. Does that make sense?
What is F of U again?
F of U is the set of all the real continuous. Is the set of all continuous functions from U to R. Okay, so again, so if you look at map, if you look at a function here, you restrict that to a function here. Right? And this map is natural in a way. We're actually defining it this way. Now, another, so So now, another thing is that if I have two functions, let's call this G1 and G2, for these two open subsets, and they agree on the intersection, right? So if you look at each point intersection, those two agree, then they should glue up to a map from the whole map, the whole thing, right? So we're gonna have this idea of restriction, which we have, and we're gonna have an idea of gluing things together that agrees on their intersection, right? And if you have these two, what you got yourself is a sheaf. So basically, a sheaf is from every single open set of a topology on a set. Then every single open set, we have a bunch of data. Now this data restrict down nicely, and it glues up nicely. Do you want me to actually write a whole definition down? Or we can just move up?
Yes, please. Wait, can you write the definition?
Yeah, sure. Like the whole, like the real definition?
Just like the short one.
Okay, sure. Short one. Okay, so given a top, S, right? We can define the category of open sets of X.
We're going to call it open of X.
With this is that if you have inclusion, so if you have V and U are open sets of X, and V inclusion U, when you have a map V to U. Don't worry if you don't actually understand all of this. And so this gives us a category. Okay? Now, a pre-sheaf is a functor. It's a functor F from this open set to any set value category. So for example, abelian. Such that, actually, yeah, that's it. A contravariant, actually. A contravariant functor. Now, a sheaf is a pre-sheaf that, the best way to put it is actually, it satisfies an exact sequence of 20 sets. So it satisfies this exact sequence. If you satisfy this exact sequence, if any pre-sheaf that satisfies this exact sequence, it's a sheaf.
Yeah. Is that a surjection arrow there in the middle?
No, this is called the coequalizer. Yeah, this you have two maps going this way, and they have to agree on a certain thing. So yeah, it's a little complicated.
What is the pi?
Oh, pi is the product, like the product of groups, infinite product in this case. Okay, it's not the right sense. Because it's infinite, we're looking at limits of such things. So, it's, yeah. But the way you should think about a sheaf is that if you have, for every open set of this topology, you have data only. And this data glues up and they restrict down in a very, very nice way. So, any manifold is a sheaf, and any vector bundle is a sheaf. That means a locally free sheaf. Well, let's not get into that yet. Now, that's all good and well, but why do we need sheaves, right? So, here's the idea of why sheaves are important. And again, we're gonna deal with manifolds. So, this time I'm just gonna take, let's take R2R, make it easy. So we take R2R. Now, imagine, so R is a real number, right? So imagine you have a point in R. Let's say A. Okay? Now, for every single open set of A, you have all this information on this open set, right? So you have the sheaf of A, right? The sheaf of U, right? Mapping to R, right? As you get closer and closer, that gives you more local and more local information about A, right? So for example, something like 1 over X cannot exist on the whole R because at a zero, it doesn't make any sense. Right? But now, it makes sense around this point right here. Right? Because it exists around this point. It exists in the neighborhood around this point. So as we get more local and more local, we should have local information about A that's not expressed in a global way. And that's really the idea of a sheaf. So as you get more local and local, what you get is you get a ring, right? So if you look at the whole map of R2R, you get a ring. And if you're looking, if you localize it in a way,
formality is the co-limit of all the open sets containing A of FU. Taken in a category of the object, in this case, in rings.
And what you get is you get something called a local ring.
Oh, God, this is going to get pretty good. So let's call this local ring UA.
Okay, what a local ring is, in this case, what you get is, if you have any continuous function, for example, fraction of polynomials, as long as it has no zero, so if the denominator has no zero at A, so if x minus A is not in the denominator, then it should exist around the point A. Right? It makes sense though. Right? So if that's true, then what local ring is that? It means that this ring has only one maximum ideal. And the elements in this maximum ideal, which I'm going to denote as M, is all the things that vanishes at A. Or M is the set of all the functions around A. So all the functions that exist over open neighborhood of A, such that F taking at A is equal to zero. Right? So now if you take the local ring, and if you module it by its unique maximum ideal, what you get, you should get R. Right? So what you essentially get is, if you take a function close, so what geometrically mean is that if you take a function close enough, say this function right here, this is 1. Okay. So if you take a function close enough at A, right? So it exists around A. Now, if you're quotient by the maximum ideal, what you get is you get the evaluation of the function f at A. Okay?
Yes. So when you say you're looking at around A, are you specifying some open set around A, or are you?
Yes. We're considering. So the idea of a co-limit is that if it exists in any open set around A, it's good enough, because any small open set will also exist too, right? So the co-limit is the idea that it kind of carry around all the information, all the big ones to really really small ones, and kind of glue them together in a really really nice way, such that any polynomial that basically does not go infinity at A can be found here. That's basically what it is. Yes?
That limit in what category?
In this case, it's only in the category of rings.
Just like the category of rings with gradient morphisms, or just the...
Just ring or real morphisms. It's a category of rings. Okay, because, and the co-limit is nice because this category here, because it behaves the way we want to. Because the forgetful functor from rings to sets has a free algebra associated with it. Therefore, the left limit commutes with the right, so it commutes. So it's set theoretically. Okay. So So notice we have this notion of evaluation. But you take a function exists somewhere around A, right? You plug A into this co-limit, which is like, all the things that are closing it, you quotient out by the maximum ideal, and what you get, you should get FA, the evaluation at A. Now, what people realize is that this has nothing to do with A. I literally can make this any point I want, and I get something that's an evaluation, right? I get a number back, in this case, in R. That's what I want, but it has nothing to do with A. Right. In this case, we have a manifold in R, which is why it's nice, right? So because we define a function from a manifold by defining the value of each point. But what happens if we don't do that? Because it can be any data. We still have this notion of evaluation, which is what we're going to get to. So
Gutenberg knew this. So he saw this whole thing, Loret did sheaves and stuff. He knew this. So he looked at algebraic geometry. Mm. In fact, he's actually studying functional analysis before he came into algebraic geometry, which is really funny, because functional analysis sucks. because I don't understand it, let's be honest. Nobody does. So classically, so if you have a variety, right? So we study things, that's called variety. Why are they bad? One thing, they are embedded. Right? So if you think of writing, we really think of writing in some bigger space, right? But now it doesn't have to be. So if we study manifolds, as you know, exactly know, you can study manifolds away from any ambient space it's sitting, right? So we want the same thing here, but that's not really why it's bad. Second thing why it's bad, it has to be over algebraically close field. It has to, pretty much you have to work over C. Because if you work over R, if I write the equation x squared plus y, it has no solution. Right? It doesn't make any sense. It makes absolutely no sense for this equation. But over C it does, because it's algebraically close. Okay? So I want to work, and for number theoretic people, you want to work over, you know, you want to work over FP, right? And I don't know if you do, but you can work over local fields if you want. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on that one. Okay? And third limitation, its topology is not very nice. There are certain things. So what certain things that you can write that give you the same variety, but it shouldn't be the same. So for example, if you think about in R2, if I say the polynomial is x, what does that describe? Actually, y. It describes this line, right? That's all the, because every single on this line is something of a0, right? So, you know, it's 0. Right? So you plug in a0 here, a0 time. That's the answer. Now, what about y squared? If I say y squared is 0, then it's the exact same line. But y squared and y is very different. Because if you look at, if you look at the polynomial of x and y, you quotient by y, you get a polynomial by x. Now, if you do it over y squared, we get something that's non-reduced, right? I mean, that's exactly what it is, right? So y is still in here, and if you square it, it's not reduced. So it's in the neo-radical, right? So if you look at algebraic step one, it's neo-radical. And the variety, the points you call, they're the same points. But there's something bad about y squared that's away from y. So in algebraic, in scheme theory, algebraic, we can describe y squared as this kind of a flow around this line. But you can't do that in varieties because they're just points. So which is why this is the third topic. So you think about things like neopotency. Fourth point. I want to do algebraic geometry over. Again, algebraic geometry is really restricted and. What Gruden did this is you can basically analyze any ring ever. Plus something, yes.
For the benefit of people here, can you say quickly what nilpotency is?
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, so if you have a ring, okay, so you take a ring R, the nilpotency. So if I have an element x in the ring, then if x to the n is zero, then x is nilpotent. So if you multiply itself enough times equal to zero is nilpotent. So for example, in this ring right here, then y squared is in the ideal you're quotienting by. So it's zero in the quotient. Okay? Does that explain it? Yeah? Alright, sweet. Now, okay, so let's get into it. So we're gonna do schemes. So a scheme. So what a scheme is, A scheme is a sheaf on the top space. So what we have to do is we have to define the topological space. Then we have to define the sheaf only. Then we can make ourselves a scheme. Think that's simple. Okay. So what it starts with is R. So if you give me any ring, again, ring means when I say ring, I mean commutative. Because the other ones doesn't exist. And you can know. One is empty as well. Okay? Okay. So if you have a ring, then we can define the set of all the prime ideals in the ring. Prime ideals are very nice. Okay? We call this the spectrum of the ring. Now, all these prime ideals, I think, if you guys actually want to see the construction of the scheme, or I can just kind of gloss over that. You want to see it yet?
Go for it.
Okay, sure. Okay, so the idea is that, so what we're really concerned is polynomial rings. So if you have, now we're done away with C now, people, okay, we're going to do your arbitrary field. So if you have the polynomial ring, x1 to xn, right? Now, if you give me an element of the ring, what it really is, it's a function, right? So if you have f in this ring, it's a polynomial, right? So you have this ideal f, right? And now if I give you a prime ideal, let's say I write it as p, we can ask whether f is in p or not, right? Now there are very special kind of prime ideals in the polynomial ring. Which I'm talking about? I'm talking about the maximum ideals, the absolute maximum. So they are performed x1 minus a1 to xn minus an, right? They are in bijection. So I'm basically saying that x1 should be a1, xn should be an. And they are in bijection with Kn space, which is the original space we're talking about. Because Grothendieck knew that, everybody knew that, it's this nice bijection. It's not very, very nice, except when it's algebraically closed, because they were those limits, which I'm not going to get into. But I can ask if f, so for example, if I have this maximum ideal, then if f is in this maximum ideal, it's really the same thing as saying that f of a1, if you plug a1 to an in here, is zero. Right? Which is the original definite variety we came up with. So there's a bijection between something belong to a prime ideal and this function vanishes at this point. And that's really the main bridge we're going to draw it from. So the idea of spec R is that we define something called a non-vanishing set. Okay, so if I give you a set, I give you an ideal of R, okay, I can define V of I in spec R. Remember, right now spec R is just a set. So the V of I in spec R is the set of prime ideals in R such that I is belong to the prime ideal. Okay? So it's a simple containment. But because of things like this is why we're interested in it. Yes?
Can you was that the construction of the scheme?
No. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, let's go back. So a scheme is a shape on a top space.
Like, is okay. It a specific topological space?
Right now, I'm sorry, I should go over this. If I have a ring, I can construct a set, right? The set of all prime ideals.
Sure.
We're going to put, I'm sorry, I didn't say this. We're going to put a topology on the prime ideal. So that's a top space. Then we're going to construct a shape on the topology. Okay, I'm sorry. So now when we have this as a set, what I'm doing right now is I'm actually defining closed sets. That's really what I'm doing. So if you have an ideal, I can define the set of all the prime ideals in vanishing. Right? And if you just, this is basic algebra, if you have ui intersect vj, is the prime ideal that contains both I and j, is equal to v I plus j. And if you have ui union uj, is equal to v I j. Or is it also equal to I intersect J. Okay. The idea of how we're going to define a top in this space. Yes.
What is the I? What is the I?
V is the set of all the prime ideals that vanishes that I is in the prime ideal. Okay.
Yeah.
Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Now,
what is I?
I set an ideal.
Oh, sorry.
Like maximum ideal?
No, any idea. Actually, any set would work. But because yeah, exactly. So we just have ideals. Okay. Now, I declare the topology on spec R is the weakest topology such that all these sets are closed. Actually, if you get all these sets are closed, then you actually define topology. Okay, I'm not going to get into proving the problem things. You can do that in top one.
So now we have this nice thing called spec R. It's a top space. Now the final step is putting a sheet on it. And the idea, now this is where people have to start grinding for this. So if you have a ring, right? So we define this topological space on it. Now, let's talk about the open set, because open set is important. So this is a basis of this. This is a basis of spec R, and we'll write the set of basis is D F, where F is a element of the ring, and D F is defined to be all the prime ideals in R. So if you have all the prime ideals in R, such that F is not contained in the prime ideal, you can see how this is the complement of the other one. Why this is why this is the open set, right? And turns out this DFs as F are elements, they're not sufficient enough to make a topology, but they generate the base of the topology. And once we define a base, we define a topology, right? Now the idea of a sheaf, why it's so important, what distinguishes it from pre-sheaf is that you can actually, if you define a sheaf on a base, you have defined enough. Sheaf are such local object that if you define it on any field covering, then it's good enough. And that goes into things like couldn't take a party. That's what it is. And turquoise. I don't think it's like that. Because I don't know. But so what we have to do is we have to define sheaf for every single DF in there. And this is only one way to do it. So globally, we're going to define the sheaf. We're going to call it, let's call it just F. So F of spec R globally of the whole set is equal to R, right? So F is a map from the open diagram of spec R in rings. Okay. We want to work with this. Okay. So globally, but now the real question is, what's F of BF for any F? And the tricky thing that you have to realize is that because if you look at all the prime ideals, that F is not in there, right? So what you're saying is that if I localize an F, then I still will have these prime ideals. The primes should still be in there, right?
You can go in if you want.
Oh, okay, cool. So F at DF is actually R localized. You're fine. Okay, and you have to prove what makes a sheaf sheaf. So you have to give all the maps, you have to show what will be the T identity, and it turns out it's actually a partition of unity argument, if anybody knows what partition of unity is. Yeah, C or code a partition of unity argument. And therefore, we have defined a scheme. That's what we define. And the really thing I want to point out is if I have a prime ideal P, right? So which is a point in the scheme, right? And you're asking me, what's the stop? So if you zoom in at the prime ideal, what do you get, right? So if you're looking at the localization at P, what you get is actually really nice. You get R localized at P. Does anybody know? Okay? Does anybody want to ask what does that mean?
You should maybe give a quick note about localization.
Should I give up? Okay, sure. Okay. Localization. So localization starts with Z, right? So if you have Z, I want to be Q, right? What I do is I add fractions in there, right? So two starting over the volume Z, right? So I want to have a notion of I can take fractions of elements, and that's really the idea. So in this case, what R of F means that is if you define a set, a multiplicatively closed set, let's call it D. And in this case, D is going to be equal to 1, F squared, going forever. Now, I really artificially defined something that's called D inverse of R. So basically, I can formally take all the fractions of elements of D. In this case, it's F. So for example, if you have the ideal, if you have 2, right? So if you look at the set, D2 is equal to 1, 2, 4, going on forever, then D2 inverse of Z, when we localize it, is equal to like it's basically equal to the set of number n over 2. Right? So it's a little bit bigger than the integer, right? You can take fractions with 2 now. Right? Does that make any sense? And so, for example, you can have 57 over 2 to the 10th. You know, because you can take fractions with elements in this set. So this is the same idea. So in this case, I'm localizing over f times square f to the n. It's a locally closed set. But in this case, I'm actually taking localization at all the elements away from a prime ideal. Mm-hmm. This is one of the reasons why prime ideal is so nice. Because if you have f, that's not in the prime ideal. If you have g, that's not in the prime ideal. Then fg is not in the prime ideal. That's by definition prime ideal. So which means that r minus p is a locally closed set. Okay, and which means that you can localize it, add it, and this is what you get. And this is a local ring with p. P and p is the maximum ideal in this local ring. So what you get is, so you have fp is isomorphic to r localized fp, right? And you have the maximum ideal is equal to p, the image of p generating this maximum ideal. And if you take the quotient, you get the rest, we'll call this the residue field at p. Okay, now let's go back and do an example because, you know, that was all the stuff.
Can you say what that functor was that you had up there?
Yeah, the functor was from the category of open sets of spec R to rings. Because we're one of rings, right? Because the structure should be rings. Okay, now, so if I take an example, just look at x and draw one element, okay, one maximum ideal is x, right? So you look at a point at x, so what you get is you're looking at k of x localized at x. That's basically all the polynomials that does not have an x in the denominator. Right, so for example, I can write x cubed plus 1 plus h, not h, plus 2, over x minus 1 squared, x plus 5x squared. For example, that's not as x is not in the denominator. So if you plug in 0 in the denominator, it doesn't vanish, it's not 0, then you're fine. But now, when you localize at x, which is the maximum ideal, okay, you basically take evaluation, say that x is 0. Then this is 0, 1, so this is 3 over, this is 1, and this is, this is 0. Okay, let's change it up. You get 5 over 0 over 5. Right, you're basically taking evaluation at a point. Right, we'll ask what f of 0 is. But we didn't do it. Right, this is an abstract way of declaring what evaluation is without respect to our numerical value of plugging polynomials, right? So it's much more abstract, but it works the same way. So,
yes. I'm still unclear about the localization itself.
Okay, sure.
Whenever you're doing the localization, are you taking subfields of the fraction field, or what? Or something to the fraction field?
Yes, but you can say that, yes. But if it's not in the root domain, it doesn't have a fraction field.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The choice, you won't have a fractional field. And if you have an integral domain R, the fractional field is defined by this R equal to 0 inverse of R. That gives you localize every single element away from the 0, and that actually gives you the fractional field. Okay.
And I think in general the construction you just need it to be multiplicatively closed.
Yes, you need it multiplicatively closed.
Okay.
Yeah. You basically what you do is that you just kind of define formal sum, and you just declare the relationship, kind of like the way we define Q and C. We just declare this, kind of like tensor.
Yeah,
that's the only way it is. I mean, again, that everything is tensor. So, you quotients, localizations, adding a variable is actually tensor too. So yeah. So do you guys want me to keep going?
Let's see. Well, I can just tell you I've got 15 minutes of battery life left, so.
Okay, and.
Memory card left, actually.
Everybody else. I mean, our world with what? Oh, this is a bug. This is. This is just the beginning of it. Somebody asked.
So, when are you going to apply to Bayes' theorem? Isn't that the goal?
Yes, that's the goal, and it's like a really long way from the goal.
So, how long do you think it'll take you from here?
An hour.
Yeah. Hmm. Thoughts? Anybody?
You can go anytime you want, but if anybody wants to learn, I will tell them.
Maybe if we do that, maybe we can convene, like, to take a short break, and then.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Okay. How about you, if you guys want to break?